the tone, please record your message. When you've finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Hi, John. I'm Jim Fingal. I'm the intern who's been assigned to fact-check your article about Las Vegas. And I've discovered a small discrepancy between the number of strip clubs you're claiming there are in Las Vegas and the number that's been given in your supporting documents. I'm new at this, so bear with me. I was hoping that you could clarify how you determined that there are 34 strip clubs in the city while the source you're using says 31.
Hi, Jim. I think maybe there's some sort of miscommunication, because the article, as you call it, is fine. It shouldn't need a fact checker. At least that was my understanding with the editor that I've been working with. I've taken some liberties in the essay here and there, but none of them are harmful. But I've also given the magazine all of my research so that people there could see for themselves what I was up to when I took these liberties. So I'm not sure it's going to be worth your time to fact check this.
I hear you, but I think it's just policy to fact check all the nonfiction pieces the magazine publishes. Plus, it's the job I was assigned to do, so I have to do it. But really, I think they just want to make sure all the facts of the piece add up, especially since there are a lot of them, and your claims sometimes get a little inflammatory. In a good way, of course. So, could you help me out with that number?
Inflammatory?
I mean, in a hard-hitting and intriguing way. Wrong choice of words, sorry.
All right. Well, from what I can remember, I got that number by counting up the number of strip clubs that were listed in the local Yellow Pages at the time of Levi's death. However, since that issue of the phone book was long gone by the time I started writing this, I found that porn article that I gave the magazine so that they could check up on my estimate.
Thanks, John. Very helpful. Now, I guess that's where the discrepancy is, because the number that's mentioned in the article is different from the number that you're using in your piece.
Well, I guess that's because the rhythm of 34 works better in the sentence than the rhythm of 31, so I changed it.
Ah. Okay. Well, thanks for your time, John. I'll probably be checking back with you later on.
I was working for the Believer magazine in San Francisco, and I was doing miscellaneous things like copy editing, proofreading, and I was also doing a fair amount of fact-checking for different articles in that magazine. And this essay by John, which had previously been written for Harper's, but killed on the account of factual discrepancies, came into the Believer, and I was assigned to fact-check it.
Jim Fingal is a software developer in Cambridge, Massachusetts, but he spent around 7 years as a fact-checker working on a single piece. Journalist and essayist John DeGatta's questionably truthful What Happened in Vegas, which chronicled the circumstances surrounding the suicide of a young man named Levi Presley. Their 7 years of correspondence has been turned into a book, The Lifespan of a Fact.
So it came in, and I was given the background that this piece was killed from Harper's because the author stood up for, you know, his art, and he changed some facts, but he refused to have them be corrected. And so maybe we'll fact check this and there'll be 10 things that he changed, and maybe we'll publish that in the front matter of the book, and it'll be like an interesting commentary on the nature of the essay and facts. But then getting into the project, as you might be able to gather, there are more than 10 things that have been changed. At the end of the fact-checking, from a like 10-page single-spaced essay, I came out with like a 90-page document.
At the tone, please record your message.
Factual dispute. According to the coroner's office, there were 2 heart attacks that day. But besides these 2 particular coronary cases handled by the coroner's office, there were an additional 5 cardiorespiratory arrests and 1 additional myocardial infarction, which were never investigated by the coroner's office, presumably because they took place in hospitals. So there were actually 8 heart attacks that day, not 4. John, should we change this 4 heart attacks to 8?
I like the effect of these numbers scaling down in the sentence from 5 to 4 to 3, etc. So I'd like to leave it as is.
But that would be intentionally inaccurate.
Probably.
Aren't you worried about your credibility with the reader?
Not really, Jim. No. I'm not running for public office. I'm trying to write something that's interesting to read.
But what's the point if the reader stops trusting you?
The readers who care about the difference between 4 and 8 might stop trusting me. But the readers who care about interesting sentences and the metaphorical effect that the accumulation of those sentences achieve will probably forgive me.
I guess I'm confused. What exactly are the benefits of using 4 versus 8 in this sentence?
I'm done talking about this.
You start off this correspondence with John in a very friendly way, like as you would, I can imagine, as somebody who is assigned with having to confront somebody about potential discrepancies in a piece of work. I feel like the tone in John's responses at the beginning, they sound like the kind of guy who has just had to deal with the frustrations of Philistines for a long time.
Yeah, well, and some background, I mean, the correspondence text in the book is not word for word what was actually exchanged between John and I. I maintain that our correspondence was mostly cordial for the entire time that we worked together, which was, you know, initially over the course of almost a year. He insists that he was cold to me and that he was frustrated. In his words, an impossibly young upstart was challenging him about a piece that he had finished and polished and asking him to change words in the piece. I was frustrated about spending hundreds and hundreds of hours on this thing that was just going to go in a drawer. We sort of shaped the correspondence that you find in the book. We let those inner voices come out.
At a certain point, did you feel like you were just playing a cat and mouse game where you're just like, I'm going to literally go into every fact? Or were you taking everything seriously with the tune of a fact checker?
I had a high-level scope of what could be verified, but the initial pass through the essay was going through and bolding everything that could possibly be verified, whether or not it would ever actually end up being verified. You know, fact-checking, the job is every proper noun, every assertion that could possibly be verified outside of the world of the essay. So basically everything other than people's opinions and sometimes people's opinions. There's like a continuum both in terms of verifiability and in terms of how important is this actually for the publication or the accuracy of the piece. And I think the latter question, how important is this for the accuracy of the piece, I certainly go probably farther than was expected. For example, the color of the bricks outside of the stratosphere and disputing that they look brown rather than red, or the color of mountains in the distance when standing on top of the stratosphere. I relied on stuff that quote-unquote real fact-checkers or fact-checkers who are paid to do what they what they do wouldn't rely on, such as, you know, sources on the internet, for example, rather than calling like primary sources. My deep-seated fear is that a real fact-checker is going to read this book and tear apart my methodology, because I was never formally trained in the role. It was something that I picked up as an unpaid intern and did for a few years.
My mom was beading jewelry to make some extra cash. Since he won't give me his mother's contact information, I can't confirm this, nor whether or not she really has a cat. And a need for some extra cash. So she must be quite the artist to be able to sell her handicraft for extra cash.
Tread very carefully, asshole.
The stuff that I skimmed through seemed very much like what we would do to fact check. Like, it seemed like he was checking like newspaper articles from the time or like databases and things like that. And that is actually all what a good fact checker should be doing. And to the extent that he seemed like annoying and obsessive, like that's how you feel every second of being a fact checker. Like, your job is to be really, really pesky. And so like nobody is your friend, and you know this.
Gillian Brazel, like Jim Fingal, spent some time as a proofreader and later a fact checker. She worked for GQ.
I mean, actually anything that could possibly be contested factually, like, you will search in the most definitive source possible. So like, you call the government whenever the government would know. You always try to call the direct source. You read transcripts of any quotes for interviews that were done for it. If there are like articles or like studies that were used to write the piece, then you have to read all of them and make sure you really understand what's going on. But the thing that seems kind of crazy about it is like I needed to call this like Canadian teenager who wrote a letter to GQ. And like the only ways that you can find these people's phone numbers are so weird. It was like literally me scrolling through his Twitter, seeing if he had posted his phone number or like trying to find email addresses for him to, it's just like a strangely bootleg system. Like 50% of the time you need to be like anal to the point of being unpleasant, because like I think about this now, it ruins you as a reader. Every time I read a New Yorker article now, I'm like, how would they really check this? Did they just take her word for it? Who did they talk? What's their source on this? And like a bunch of my friends are like, whoa, I'd love to be fact checkers. And there's no polite way to say like, you were nowhere near annoying enough to be able to bother people all day. I remember my very first exposure to fact checking was when I was interning, and there was a woman who was having to watch an entire season of True Blood because she needed to count how many times this one guy was shirtless, and she was like swamped. And so as an intern, she was like, can you take these discs and go like, I need you to help me out. Like, can you watch some of these and count how many times he's shirtless? And I was like, this is someone's job. So I spent all day at work watching movies and like counting the number of dead bodies in a thing, or how many times somebody says fuck, or like the really simple things you can get away with watching like 25 minutes of a movie. But when it's talking about general plot stuff, or like, as you see the transition of this relationship from hate to love, then like you really have to stick it out and watch the transition from hate to love. And sometimes the movies are awful. I watched so many Ryan Reynolds movies this summer. I don't know if you know him, but that was, I think, probably when I most thought, this is stupid. As an intern, I would have been like, this is fun. And as a paid person, I was like, I can't believe people get paid for this. Well, print is dying. How is print dying? I'm getting paid to watch this right now. It bummed me out when there was something, I'll explain the actual story, but when there was something that was like very definitively fucked up about what someone else was doing, but that like no one seemed surprised by it. So basically this piece didn't end up running, so I don't think it's, I'll just talk about it in general terms. Basically famous people were supposed to write about like their favorite obscure movie, and it was going to be run as like the best movies you've never seen. Most of the movies were terrible. Like, there's a reason you haven't seen them. But anyway, this very well-known, like, you would know his name, very well-known fashion designer wrote about, I think it was like a Brazilian movie. I don't remember. And so when I was just trying to do some general background, like, you have to watch the movie and make sure all the plot details are right. And when I was doing some very general background reading on it on Wikipedia, not used as a source, but trying to, like, figure out how I should be thinking about it, I noticed that, like, in the critical reception part, there was a quote from Ebert from his review that was like almost verbatim in the thing that the fashion designer had written. And then two lines down from Pauline Kael's review, like two more lines that were just in the thing. And so like I run excitedly to the editor and was like, whoa, can you believe this? Like, look at this. And they were like, oh, yeah, we'll probably delete that. That's pretty funny. And I was like, how is this not blowing your mind right now? I can't believe this. Straight plagiarism. I've never seen it. And they were like, yeah, okay, we just won't include it. And that was it. So that makes me think that like that kind of thing happens all the time, which is so distressing to me. And it was also kind of awesome because I wouldn't have figured that out unless I'd been reading Wikipedia as background, because of course, like Wikipedia is like verboten in the fact checker's room. But I was like, you know, God bless Wikipedia, because this is where people are going to plagiarize from.
Yvonne Rolshausen, you've been running the fact-checking department at The Atlantic for the last few years. Tell me what fact-checking is all about. How do you sum it up to people who don't know what it is?
I basically say that it is double-checking all of the details in a piece, from the smallest piece up to the biggest piece, to make sure that everything that we're saying is as true as it can possibly be. And that means reading the same books that the author read, watching the same movies, talking to the same people, just having sort of acting as a bit of a conscience on an author's shoulder and rethinking what they're saying. So basically, we try to make sure that we have a sound argument. Oftentimes, truth is very dependent on who you ask and who you get. So we are only as good as our sources. And also, every source has a very different level of interpretation. So unless we're talking about scientific data that can't be argued about, pretty much everything is open to a level of interpretation. But there's a checker has to be very, very interested in continuing to sort of turn over stones until you find the right answer.
Well, the way you describe it, it actually changes, I guess, my original bias about what fact-checking was, because I was kind of picturing that the fact-checker is that, you know, kind of obnoxious person who comes in and says to the author, well, basically, everything that you wrote is under scrutiny now, and we're going to go through it with a fine-tooth comb.
Yes, this is the schoolmarm attitude towards checking, and that's certainly true. Of what, and it's certainly representative of what some checkers can be. I mean, it really is. There are some out there who do that, and I certainly do that. But it's just, you know, realistically, any author has been working long and hard on a piece. They could be working on it for years. They could be working on it for 2 weeks. But regardless, they have an intimate knowledge with it, or certainly should, and certainly if they're writing for a publication of esteem, they are. So ultimately, I think that my approach to it is to always assume that they had a reason for writing something, and they had a reason for putting it a certain way. So who am I to sort of jump in and say, oh, and you're wrong on 73 things? I can say to them, I found different things than these 72 points that you make, but let's talk it through. And so I talk it through. Did you use this date for a certain reason? Okay, it seems like every single place puts it at this date. Let's change it. Wrong is not a word that I like or I like my checkers to use, because realistically, no one wants to get a slap on their wrist. We make mistakes all the time. Why should we be in a position to immediately assume that an author is wrong in something? They're wrong because of speed, because a source tells them something without thinking it through. They're wrong because they quickly had to find out a detail for an editor and threw out a Wikipedia number. They're very, very different reasons for why someone writes something.
Well, you bring up an important point about how people can be wrong in statements that they make, assertions that they choose to put in their articles, because it always seems like there's a binary to truth mm-hmm. and falseness. What is it that you use to kind of play around with there's a gray area, and there's a room for creative interpretation, and then there's all kinds of assertions that
everything is gray in my world. It really is. It's a funny thing that most people will sort of constantly ask me, okay, well, who do you believe, and how do you come to this? And I think there's a scale. I basically sort of talk about it being that you sort of go to the center point. Okay, scale is not really the, well, there is a scale, but it's almost like, okay, you have to always try to think, who is the person who is in a position to be the expert on this? And so if it's a detail about you, I go to you. If it's a detail that I can't reach you or you're dead, I go to someone who's an expert on you, someone who's written multiple books on you, someone who studied your work, a scientist who worked under another scientist. You basically go as close as you possibly can to that bullseye. And if you can't hit that bullseye, you go out in concentric circles. But once you start going out in concentric circles, you then try to hit multiple people on that. Because as we all know, someone who's writing about Churchill disagrees with the 7,000 other people who have written about Churchill. So you sort of have to then, once you get out past the focus, then you try to dance around with other places of information and other pieces in it. But that's as good as I have, because the reality is that, you know, I'm an expert about myself, and that's pretty much it at this point. Okay, I know my way around fact-checking in magazines, and okay, anything else is beyond my scope of true understanding and truth. the reality too is that, you know, oftentimes, you know, truth does sort of ruin a good story. You know, it's not quite as sexy to have to put in the hedges and such. So there's that as well. And, you know, that happens for anyone telling a story.
He found a space on the fifth level, the blue level, three spaces away from the elevator. No evidence of this in John's notes. I can confirm that there are non-handicapped parking spots three spaces away from the elevator, however, and that the fifth level is indeed the blue level, so this is at least potentially correct. However, when I was there on a Saturday morning in the early autumn, almost the entire fifth level was already full. Seems a stroke of fate that he'd be able to get that space. John, where is this information coming from?
Your nitpicking is absurd, and it's ruining this essay. So as I've said, I'm not participating. Good luck.
In other words, you're taking your ball and going home. Very mature. You know, confirming factual details so that a piece like this has some semblance of accuracy isn't nitpicking. And I think most readers would agree with me. This process is actually meant to help enhance your writing. But I can't imagine you could appreciate anything that would require you to alter your precious words, which no doubt fell into the world from your pen, fully formed and immaculate.
Yeah, I'm the immature one.
One thing that you bring up in the correspondence that I think is kind of the nut of the question is you're talking to John and you say that basically this essay, which is the core of it, is about the death of a young man named Levi Presley. You're saying that when this essay is released, this will be a definitive article, a historical record of the death of this young man. So that in the future, when anybody is going back to research this, if anybody does, this will be something that comes up as, you know, potentially the number one source. A few years from now, even like a few months from now, these conversations that people are having about whether something is true or not will be dust. You know, no one will want to necessarily go back through there and read that, or most people won't. So the historical record wants to choose one thing and say, this is what happened on this date, rather than parse through all the discrepancies. I wonder what was John's reaction to that?
I think John's reaction is that the essay that he wrote never really intended to play the role of a historical record, and that we shouldn't look to art as something that we can trust, basically. It's something that should challenge us and make us think, but is not something that we should look to for absolute veracity about the things of the world. Sort of get down to the nature of what is a fact and what is the fact-checking process. So, you know, a fact is something that exists in the world or something that happened, or some assertions or arguments can enter into that realm. And how do you verify them? How do you know that they're true? What is the source of knowledge and how we know things about the world? So you can personally verify things. You can observe things yourself, which in of itself is flawed, since perceptions can be skewed and memory faulty. The main other source of verifying things as a fact checker is to rely on other people's descriptions of their first order verifications or observations or interpretations of things. And that's something that's mediated through language, and language which is often imprecise. So the process of fact checking any given assertion very quickly gets into this network of people making statements that they based off of other people making statements that they based off different sources. And the level of confidence that you can have in any given assertion is how much do you trust that network and the different nodes in that trust network.
Do you have a feeling that the role of the fact checker is being pushed to the wayside or being replaced? Or could be replaced. There's so much more urgency in publishing online with the web. There's so much more like of a rush to just get things put up and then checked later, or trusting crowdsourcing to come in and check, or comment sections to come in and dispute what you've written. Do you feel like the role of the fact checker has changed with the web?
Well, I think that people are becoming more comfortable accepting things that don't have a strong trust network behind them. The example of this is Wikipedia, which you can't use as a source for publication. You can reference it, but to really know whether anything up there is true, you need to sort of rely on the references in it, and effectively always goes to, you know, the experts or the official record. You know, certainly myself, when, you know, I'm looking up a variety of facts, I think probably I don't bring enough skepticism to it where I, you know, hold it at an arm's length, but, you know, in the back of my mind, I have this idea that this is roughly the picture of what I'm getting at, and that's sort of good enough. I think that's probably a common thing where the deep skepticism about the veracity of the piece may be suppressed by a trust in the goodwill or the power of the crowd to eventually arrive at the truth. The sheer amount of time and effort that goes into checking a paragraph or a chapter, and I don't want to say seeming impossibility, but certainly it raises skepticism of the ability of, for example, a daily newspaper to check things on that level. I think to a large degree that relies on the sort of reputation of the writers themselves who are expected to check their sources. And I've never worked at a newspaper. I don't actually know what the fact-checking processes are like there, but I imagine that there are constraints on the depth to which things can be verified, particularly in things that are timely.
Well, you come into the book towards the end to actually, it felt to me to be more just frustrated with the idea of what a fact is than necessarily coming around to John's opinion of an essay and having it be okay that an essay is a creative interpretation for a greater truth.
My concern in the book is basically, while John's essay was written in the spirit of the essay being something that is not equivalent to journalism and should be granted the full range of literary tools that a novelist or a poet or someone doing any other form of writing has in order to shape the narrative. And that's not the world's definition. And so the difficulty there is something that for the author is presented as a work on one grounds is going to be interpreted as something entirely different because of the sort of limitations and the categorizations of the genre that it's written in. You know, a meat of the essay is like, what is the commonly held definition of the essay? What are people's expectations? You know, maybe what is the effectively social contract once you call something an essay versus the, I guess, prescriptive definition that John has of what the spirit of the essay always has been and, you know, recently perhaps changed, and also his discomfort with the idea that art should have a social contract.
I was trying to think about this morning and like actually verbalize it in a normal way, but I feel like I just have very complicated feelings about it.
Jillian Brassel recently read Fingal and Degatta's book.
There was a copy of it, I think actually like an advanced copy of it, sitting in my boss's office, and I was in to work for just a day at the end of January. And I was flipping through it, and I knew who John Degatta was already because we read him in one of my classes, and I already sort of had like I want to say crinkly is not the real word, but like crinkly feelings about him because my memory of the whole thing was he's like, well, I'm just really playing with like what's fiction and what's not fiction. And I was like, this isn't so brilliant. It sounds like sometimes you make stuff up, like that's not great. So did not have the most positive feelings about him already. And then I was flipping through it and I just felt so frustrated on so many fronts. I felt like really frustrated at Degatta because it's, and like at the editors too, because it just seems really messed up to me that you would have this like poor intern fact check a piece and then tell him every single time like, yeah, but we don't really care about the facts, because then why are you having him fact check the piece? And that was just very unlike anything that I would have had to do. And also because like I was paid for it and I was, we don't let interns fact check at GQ. And so it seemed to epitomize for me like the demoralizing nature of internships in general, which is like you're not getting paid and your work doesn't matter. And for him, he was explicitly being told all the time like what you're doing actually doesn't matter. So when I was reading it, I thought like, you know, is he making all of this up? Because he could be. That's like what he's all about. Ugh. when you're publishing a book on your own terms, do whatever you want, John DeGatta. Once you're in a periodical that does publish actual journalism, also do whatever you want, but make sure it's labeled as essay and not as like reporting. I think it's just that it's hard to label things like, you know, at the top of the page instead of like feature, for it to be like slippery reporting about the past with possible subjectivity. I mean, like, there's not really ways to make it clear. I think in a form like McSweeney's, it seems appropriate to me, but I also don't buy this. Like, some essays actually are beautifully factually accurate, and I don't think that they should be lumped in with stuff that isn't, because it does require a lot more work to get it right. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Essay is pretty broad already. I think what he's doing can fall into essay. I just think I definitively don't want it to be labeled as nonfiction if it's not nonfiction.
I wonder what the process is for the Atlantic. I mean, if you have like kind of like standard operating procedures that you use that guide your fact checking, and if they, you know, they differ from other fact checkers. Like I always kind of picture, you know, like folks from different institutions of journalism who do the fact checking. They hang out or they go to conferences together, and then they you'll have somebody from the Atlantic talking to somebody from Fox News and saying, "Oh, you do it that way, we do it this way," or something like that. Is that a realistic presentation?
There isn't that. There isn't an organization. There isn't anything like that. I think it's certainly it's much more dependent. I hate to admit it, on what resources places have. I mean, the Atlantic fact-checking department was started by Bill Whitworth, who was an editor at The New Yorker, went to the Atlantic in the early 80s, I'm not sure of the exact year, and he basically recognized that there wasn't a checking department at the magazine, so he brought a fact-checker from The New Yorker who trained a staff. So our system is, I'm sure it's evolved. You know, there are slight differences in our system versus the New Yorkers, but it's part and parcel of the same one. And then, you know, I've talked to people at Consumer Reports, and theirs is a similar one. Mother Jones, you know, certainly quite similar, though. It, for most places, it's very dependent on whether or not it's interns or fellows doing it, and that's not to take away anything from them, but it's just a matter of how much time people have to do it, whether you have an overseeing research head, fact checker head, or whether it sort of catches catch can.
It seems like fact checkers are kind of the last defense, the last preventative defense against falsity being put in the kind of permanent public mm-hmm. record. And, you know, with a magazine like The Atlantic or, a journalistic source that has a reputation, you know, you're kind of not only guarding the reputation of the magazine, but at a certain point, you know, you're guarding the historical record. Does that pressure ever make itself known to you?
Constantly. yeah, realistically, in a day and age where so many people do rely on the internet, which, never mind the fact that it's certainly nothing but checked. It basically, you're talking about a group of writers who haven't gone to school for journalism. When I first started as a fact checker, we spent our time in the library, and we spent our time basically working on pieces that were written by, in most cases, someone who had either gone through the School of Hard Knocks and written all over the place and been writing for years and years and years, or gone through a program where there's certain baselines that were taught. And that's changed dramatically. And that's, you know, you can argue at length whether that's good, bad, but it does mean that there are different ethical questions that, you know, now come up that didn't necessarily come up before with journalists. I hope that as time goes on, that people recognize the value even more of that art of sort of thinking about the integrity behind something. It's changed so dramatically, and I'm not quite sure everyone sees a value in that, to be quite frank.
Right or wrong, John, people are going to have different expectations of something that's called nonfiction. There's a perceived difference in the intentionality behind nonfiction and fiction, because nonfiction is supposed to have its feet firmly planted in reality. Isn't that the definition of nonfiction?
Why do you have such a hard-on for that term? I'm not using that term to describe this essay. You are.
Because, like it or not, it's what the world calls the genre that you're working in. Maybe it's the fault of the language. We don't have enough words for snow or the variety of literary experiences. But your definition of an essay is an idiosyncratic one that is not shared with the public at large. I'm not saying that that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's a thing.
Fine. And thank you, because I doubt that they would want to be considered great examples of things that are not fictional. I don't want my stuff judged that way either.
But I'm also saying that if they were presented to me as not fictional texts, I would feel misled by them.
Fair enough.
Fair enough.
You would feel misled, sure.
So that's it.
Jim, you feel misled by my essay. I accept that. While I feel that it's a necessary part of my job to do this, that what I'm doing by taking these liberties is in fact making a better work of art, and thus a better and truer experience for the reader than I could have if I'd stuck to the facts. So fine, we disagree. I'm okay with that. But I'm also not sure where else to go.
In my mind, draw analogy between the idea of a fact and the idea of how do you establish facts and truths in science. What science does is it creates models that look like they correspond to the world, and you know, based on everything that we've seen, seems to have an overwhelming probability of being the case or being how the world works. There's never really a point in which it becomes, you know, 100% uncontroversially the case. You know, similar things can happen in, for example, history and historical record, where you can establish to the point in which it would be okay to call it a fact. even if at like a deep down level, you know that everything is based on probabilities and trust networks and such, at a certain point, it's sort of the same idea of being skeptical of free will. At a certain point, you just need to go with a position and sort of act as if that were the case until you're proven otherwise.
Facts are always facts only emerge in the context of a greater truth, but establishing a greater truth by stating things as true that are not, you know, that's pretty dicey. Depends on the context, I suppose. But it in the wrong context, which is going to be most contexts, you're eroding your readers' or listeners' trust, and that's generally not a good thing. One thing that helps is for people to become more literate. That is, to always try to understand better the nature of the various facts put forward. So the climate is changing because of human behavior, which is, as I understand it, the fundamental hypothesis put forward by people who believe in climate change, like me. That is in some sense a fact, it's true or false, but anybody who looks at it knows, or at least should know, that it is in fact a fact that results from a huge amount of subsidiary evidence and other purported facts, and a system for evaluating that evidence. It's not a simple fact like the atomic weight of helium is 4. Whatever, whatever. We're generally pretty good at understanding the various levels of fact, so to speak, and how they go together, but we can always get better at it. And keeping, being able to pull an argument apart and to recognize which things depend on what, that's a really important and basic skill of literacy.
Do these terms kind of exist on a spectrum? Is it like evidence, fact, and then truth, or something like that?
Yeah, not so much. I mean, fact has always been a peculiar term. It's technically, it's supposed to be a state of the world, but generally we don't use the term that way. We use it as something that's sort of between the way the world is and our grasp of it. And it's a squishy, surprisingly squishy concept. So there certainly are facts that we don't know. That is, they are independent of knowledge. But when we talk about facts, we usually mean facts insofar as we know them and understand them. Evidence is a different term. A fact is the way the world is. Evidence is something that we believe about the world that can lead us to other conclusions. And built into the notion of evidence is something that is excluded from the strict notion of fact. The fact is the way the world is. Evidence is some indication that the world is one way or another, and it's always probabilistic or a little bit uncertain or subject to being undone because humans and the instruments that we build are always fallible.
You know, what if a fact checker, the role of a fact checker disappeared? If journalism took the route that everybody is assuming it will, where it, you know, traditional journalism dies and you don't have these apparatuses existing where you can support the role of a fact checker to make sure that people's journalism holds up, what will have to change?
So I'm going to answer a slightly different question because I know you. So
okay.
It seems to me that the role of fact checkers is actually pretty independent of the critique of facts that has developed over the past generation or two. The critique of facts as a part of knowing says it's really not the case that we go out, we gather facts, we get certain of these, we become certain of facts and we put them together and we build a house with a strong foundation, and that's the house of knowledge. The critique of that, I think, is very well-founded. But fact-checkers do something different that's actually quite in line with the critique. The critique says, first of all, consciousness doesn't work that way. It doesn't work by building up individual bricks. And second of all, the old idea of building up knowledge brick by brick into a strong, with a strong foundation and a strong building built on top of it, makes assumptions about facts that are unwarranted. That is, that we are able to grasp them independent of our beliefs and our preferences and basically our humanity. The critique says facts are always, and which facts we choose to pay attention to is always a matter of, let's say, politics, and in some instances, a struggle for power and to maintain power and to exclude others and all the rest of it. And I think that critique is quite right. Even so, within that critique, fact-checkers have a really important role. You don't have to believe that knowledge is built up brick by brick out of fact to value the role of somebody who is able to go back, look into the world as best as she or he can, and say, well, nope, that's what you just said is probably wrong. This bit of how you are trying to piece together a picture of the world, nah, you missed it.
But would it be possible for a literate society to arise where individuals have the ability to think critically about everything that they're reading and be able to question to the nth degree what they're reading and what they're ingesting in the media?
I don't think we can rely upon individuals to do this. I mean, we all do it to one degree or another, and well or poorly, but what's at issue is not simply can an individual apprehend the truth. What's at issue is, as a culture, are we going to have institutions that have some authority so that more than one person can come to agreement? Those authorities used to be things like newspapers and encyclopedias and almanacs. The role of those institutions is changing, at the very least. We have many more people claiming to be speaking the truth. We are losing the institutional guarantee that we used to assume. that if it came from the New York Times or came from the Britannica, then we could believe that it's very likely true. So if I go out as a fact checker on my own and say, and point out errors and this or that, it's not going to make any difference in the culture. I'm just one person, and why would you believe me? But if a new institution or site comes along that is gaining credence more broadly in the culture, and they are pointing out that this or that is wrong or a lie, then they're able to affect what the culture itself believes, and thus can provide some element of stability of knowledge for that culture. So when we had a smaller set of authorities who served as quite firm stopping points for inquiry, you could just cite them and that would be the end of the discussion, we paid a pretty big price as well. Those authorities were typically closed to certain classes and genders in the not-so-distant past, and they've gone wrong, sometimes with disastrous results. New York Times recently was wrong for a year and had to apologize about the run-up to the Iraq War. The authority that we wanted to believe they had, they didn't have. Even when they didn't have that authority, the fact that there were just a handful of authorities added a certain stability to the culture. We're defined by what we believe is true. We are defined socially by that, and having fewer alternatives brought a sort of cohesion, although it was a pretty thin cohesion, and we couldn't see all the disagreement that was there. Now that there are more sources acting as authorities, even though they may not be, it does let us fragment as a culture more than we were before, and that is a price that we pay.
Yeah, well, I'd wonder if authority is defined by the individual at that point, like the authority is defined by the faith and the trust that the small group of people who are reading a certain source or ingesting a certain source are, putting in that source.
Well, I think that's always been the case. We've always defined ourselves socially by our sources. And so even when there were only three channels broadcasting the news every night and a handful of newspapers, you still defined yourself by, which are the newspapers? They quite frequently split along party lines as well as along class lines. And if you didn't like any of those, you defined yourself as a reader of the New Republic, sort of left-wing journal that defied the media, was alternative to the media, or is a reader of the Boston Phoenix, an alternative, et cetera. So we've always defined ourselves by our sources, and I think that that continues. It's a very social thing.
Have you heard about the new NPR model that they've been talking about the last few days, where one sentence in their policy that goes, if the balance of evidence in the matter of a controversy weighs like heavily on one side, they'll acknowledge it in the reports?
Yeah, reporting falsehoods, knowingly repeating falsehoods as if they were true. So yeah, that sounds like a good policy to me. This is very close to the Wikipedia neutrality policy, neutral point of view. Wikipedia wants to be neutral because it wants to tell the truth without being biased by prejudices. But they don't, therefore, put in every crazy crackpot idea as if that's what the truth consists of. They have an exquisitely designed process at this point that allows people who disagree to literally get on the same page, to come up with something that is neutral, and that excludes, say, from the evolution article, giving equal time to creationism, although they will mention it and link to it. And one of the reasons they can do that is that creationism can get its own article. They don't have to try to, they're not constrained by space. They don't have to try to get everything into that one article. If the media, the Wikipedia model of neutrality seems to me to be a pretty well-defined one that could be of use to the news media, even if the process of Wikipedia's process is not going to be used by the media. Wikipedia is providing, I think, a useful model we can learn from about what it means to tell a truthful story. It means you don't have to include every disagreement and every crazy crackpot idea, because you can mention them and link out to them to those who want to pursue them further.
Right, but there's no, like how do we perceive the dominance that, you know, in this case, like we're talking about evolution, it's perceived that evolution is the dominant and creationism is the marginalized theory, but they both have their articles on Wikipedia. How do we discern?
Because there's right. So one of the other things to learn from Wikipedia is a lesson that Wikipedia may not want us to learn, which is there is, in fact, no such thing as neutrality. Wikipedia's neutrality works because there is a certain homogeneity to the people who are editing it, which is, any of us can edit it, but there's a large distributed group of people who actually do most of the edits. That's why the Wikipedia article on the history of aviation in the English language and in the French language versions is really very different. They're both neutral, but they don't agree about who invented the airplane.
That actually just opens up one more question for me. that gets back to like where do the facts lie, you know, and where does the historical record come into play here? Like if you're looking at Wikipedia and you've got two different completely equally recognized stories about the history of aviation, where does the historical record come down? You know, don't we have to have one answer at a certain point?
The simpler the fact, the better we can establish whether it's in fact true or false, and the more trust we can have in it. But those facts tend to be, by themselves, not very interesting. It's as you go up sort of the complexity of the fact that they become really hard to decide, and you get into the, well, it depends area. So did the Republicans vote to end Medicare? PolitiFact says that this was the biggest lie of the year, where it was the Democrats claiming so. Democrats immediately pushed back, saying, in fact, we were right, and that dispute is itself now unresolved. That's a pretty high-level fact. Who invented the airplane? English and French versions of Wikipedia disagree about that. Who discovered oxygen? Historians of science disagree about that. It turns out that discovering something is not a simple on-off binary thing. It's a process. It involves lots of people. And so as we get to the facts that are more important to us, they lose the quality that we wanted in facts, which is being simple yes-nos and things that we can establish with some confidence. That makes fact-checking important, but also an art as well as a science, and also subject to human fallibility, human biases and prejudices.
Do the words fact and truth seem like they promise too much? Is there too much weight that we place on them to be solid and factual, I guess, that we just need a new word?
It might be helpful to do what scientists do, which is to talk about evidence more than about facts. A fact purports to be something that is true no matter what, and we can know it. And so there's no doubt about it. It's a fact. That's how we use the term. In common, you know, everyday language, we use fact often as a way to shut somebody up and say, no, it's a fact, as if that's it. It's done. It's you know, it's known and it's done. There are facts. The world is one way and not another, but our ability to know those facts and to know them with certainty is quite limited, because we're, you know, finite, pathetic little creatures. That's just the way we are. It might be helpful, therefore, to think less about facts and more about evidence. That is, stuff that gives some indication at some level of probability that supports some hypothesis or idea that we have. Evidence is a great human thing. We recognize when we talk about it that we're involved in it, but it's going to be imperfect. It doesn't settle all issues just by itself. It's just evidence. But scientists don't even talk about facts. Scientists talk about evidence, because the notion of a fact overstates what humans are able to grasp. It would be better if we had more of the scientists' understanding of what facts and evidence and hypotheses mean and how they work together.
This week's episode of Radio Berkman featured guests, in order of appearance, Jim Fingal, Jillian Brassel, Yvonne Rolshausen, and David Weinberger. Voice actors James Foley and Neil Leahy played the roles of Jim Fingal and John DeGatta, the co-authors of the new book, The Lifespan of a Fact. You can find out more about all of our guests at our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. Special thanks this week to Kate Krontiris and Ryan Hartigan. Today's episode was produced and edited by Francis Harlow and me, Daniel Dennis Jones, from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.